Sexual harassment scandals send Capitol Hill lawmakers packing.
Women have come forward to talk about how they felt my actions had affected them.
The FBI's chief defends his agency's reputation.
Congressman, we will not hesitate to hold people accountable.
And will President Trump's Jerusalem recognition help or hurt the peace process?
He has opened the field in a way that it has not been opened now in a generation.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next.
I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.
This week in Washington is ending with fewer members of Congress than when the week began. Three lawmakers, two members of the House, and a senator all announcing resignations this week, each facing accusations of sexual harassment and misconduct.
Over the last few weeks, a number of women have come forward to talk about how they felt my actions had affected them. I was shocked. I was upset.
Minnesota Democrat Al Franken announced his resignation, which he says will happen in a few weeks, from the Senate floor, taking at times a defiant tone, calling some accusations against him completely untrue, and comparing his treatment to Republican politicians.
I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party.
President Trump denies the accusations from more than a dozen women and explained his lewd comments about grabbing and kissing women on an Access Hollywood tape as locker room talk. And there are reports he has since tried to raise doubts that the voice on that tape is actually his. Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore has also vehemently denied he had any sexual contact with teenagers when he was in his 30s, describing allegations as a coordinated effort to defeat him. But he has not been supported up and down by Republicans. While it is true President Trump fully endorsed Moore this week and the RNC is now financially supporting the campaign, Arizona Republican Jeff Flake tweeted a photo of a $100 check he wrote to Moore's opponent, Democrat Doug Jones. In the memo line, Flake wrote, "Country over party." Fellow Alabama Republican Senator Richard Shelby says he wouldn't go that far, but he also didn't cast his absentee ballot for the Republican nominee, instead writing in someone else's name.
Well, somebody I'd be proud to be associated with.
But if Moore does win next week, the election is Tuesday, by the way, he'll likely immediately face an ethics committee investigation, a process that could jumpstart proceedings to expel him from the Senate. Here's South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham responding to a question I asked about Moore's potential admission to the Senate.
I've always been like, I don't think he should have run. I don't think he's a good candidate. The allegations have a ring of truth, but there is due process if he does get elected. I support the idea of going to the Ethics Committee. If there's a bipartisan finding that he's a child molester, it would be a defining moment in the history of the Senate.
Both the House and Senate Ethics Committees could have several sexual harassment investigations. Senator Franken referred himself to the committee when he was first accused of unwanted groping. The House Ethics Committee opened an investigation into the longest-serving member of Congress, John Conyers, and has since announced an investigation against Republicans Trent Franks and Blake Farenthold. But only Farenthold will face an investigation. That's because the mere opening of a review and credible accusations of harassment and worse have forced leadership to step in and urge swift resignations. Conyers announced an early retirement after Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi joined growing calls for his resignation. Franks was also asked to resign by Speaker Paul Ryan after the Speaker's office launched a review of harassment allegations. And Franken, who last week was contrite and apologetic while vowing to continue to serve the people of Minnesota, ultimately could not survive the pressure of more than 30 Senate Democrats, including Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, calling for his resignation. Hollywood, the media, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, and businesses across the country are all responding to a national reckoning about how powerful men treat women and other men. And in Congress, harassers and abusers may now be on notice. You can go ahead and plan a visit to a national park or a Smithsonian Museum this weekend. They're all open, courtesy of a two-week spending bill passed by Congress and signed by the president this week. The continuing resolution does just what it says. It continues current government funding through December 22nd. It also renews, through the end of the year, federal child health insurance payments. It also gives Congress two more weeks to try to settle long-standing spending and policy differences, creating a scenario for a government shutdown the weekend before Christmas. I chatted about the prospects for success with our senior Capitol Hill producer, Chad Pergram.
We have been able to set aside our imminent countdown clock to a government shutdown, at least for the next couple of weeks. So right now, a two-week spending bill gets us through December 22nd. Nothing was solved, though, in this gambit. It basically is just a straight, what we would call a clean CR. Doesn't talk about wall funding, doesn't talk about DACA, a Dreamers bill. Those issues are not going away before the 22nd, are they?
That's exactly what a continuing resolution, or CR, as you use the term here, does. It just renews the old funding. It's a continuing resolution. It continues the old funding at the same level. So what they did here is they punted. And sometime between now and December 22nd, that's where that massive fight is going to happen over keeping the government open. The Democrats are going to say, look, you know, you want to a wall. Maybe we want DACA. There's going to be some horse trading. There was a big meeting at the White House between the top four congressional leaders from both bodies, both parties, and President Trump. There was an indication from the Democrats that things went rather well, but that nothing is solved. And again, this is the scenario that the members of the House Freedom Caucus didn't want. They said if you put a bill that goes right up to December 22nd, just before Christmas, they're going to put all sorts of crazy stuff in there that they don't want, and that people will just be compelled to vote for this bill because it's the only stagecoach leaving the Capitol. And if you don't vote for that, you're going to have a government shutdown. They wanted a bill that funded the government through December 30th. I want to point out how tight that roll call vote was. We heard a lot of rattling late this week from the Democratic leader, Nancy Pelosi. If you have the votes on the Republican side of the aisle, you're the majority. Go ahead and pass the bill the way you want. But guess what? There were 18 Republican no's on that bill. That's right on the edge. At the last minute, there were no Democratic yeas on the board. 14 Democrats voted yes. And, you know, they would have had a margin of one. So basically what the Republicans did is that they demonstrated, yeah, we can pass it, but only by the skin of our chinny chin chin. And that's the existing, just renewing the current funding. What the Democrats were saying is, you know, we have a role in this process. There's certain things you're going to have to fund. And if you're going to keep the government open, we're there, but it just can't be an all Republican bill.
That's going to be an issue in the Senate as well, presumably. A bill like this is, in most circumstances, going to need at least 160 vote margin to get over the finish line. That means there's at least eight Democrats who are going to have to go along with this. That's some leverage that Chuck Schumer is wielding as well.
And that's the irony there, too, is that Mitch McConnell might say, well, wait a minute, we need eight Democratic senators. There's a lot of Democratic senators who face very competitive elections in 2018 from swing states or purple states or red states. Joe Donnelly in Indiana, John Tester in Montana. You look at Claire McCaskill in Missouri, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota. Putting in some border wall stuff or some other things, which is good red meat for the conservatives, looks like a good vote for them. So they can probably maybe take a bill that tilts toward the Republicans a little bit more in the Senate. But again, you know, the House and Senate have to be on the same page here. But to get those Republican senators on board, that's not going to be a problem. But to get the Democratic senators on board, maybe they get to 60. You need 60 votes on a bill like this. There's no special budget reconciliation package. This is a garden variety bill subject to a filibuster. The way you overcome a filibuster is with 60 votes.
So let's fast forward a couple of weeks. We get close to December 22nd. There are still these unresolved issues over DACA, over a Dreamers bill, over are we going to bust spending caps for some things and not other things. The same arguments that we've been having. What's the likelihood that they buy themselves a little bit more time, get through the holidays, come back fresh in January?
Well, you know, there was a question posed in the House Rules Committee the other night. The Rules Committee is the gateway for legislation to the House floor. And Alcee Hastings, who's a Democrat from Florida, asked the chair of the Rules Committee, Pete Sessions of Texas, would this be the last interim spending bill of the fiscal year? And Sessions could not commit to that. He said, I would hope so, but you don't know. The reason that might be a scenario is because Republicans are still trying to finish tax reform before Christmas, and that is a number one on Paul Ryan's list. If the government shuts down, there's no way they get tax reform done. That is such a virulent legislative toxin in the Capitol experience. There's no way they get tax reform done. So Paul Ryan and the Republican leadership, they might be willing to do yet another interim spending bill just to get tax reform done. The problem there is you start to lose a lot of votes on both sides of the aisle. So maybe it's tax reform that starts to fade away, not so much keeping the government open. And guess what we will know by the time that December 22nd vote rolls around?
We'll know how many Republican senators there are.
That's right. We have a special election in Alabama. Either Doug Jones or Roy Moore. And you don't know where Al Franken will be. Will he still be a senator at that point? Is that some point in the future, maybe in the new year, he steps aside? There are a lot of variables right now on Capitol Hill.
I think one of those variables, as we've learned this week, Chad, is you don't know which shoe's next to drop either.
No. And part of that is because you're dealing with all these sexual harassment scandals, new allegations, people resigning. It's really been off the chart. And that changes, you know, these vote tallies literally hour to hour.
Well said, Chad. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Do you trust the FBI? Earlier this week, President Trump on Twitter said the premier law enforcement agency's reputation is in tatters, and throughout the week has posted on what he sees as political bias within the agency and Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigative team. So with that as the backdrop, President Trump's handpicked FBI director, Christopher Wray, faced the House Judiciary Committee, and Rachel Sutherland covered it gavel to gavel.
Parallel political universes were on full display this week in the Russia probe. As the FBI, an agency that prides itself on staying out of politics, found itself embroiled in a tug of war between two narratives that have emerged out of the 2016 presidential campaign and the Russia probe, and as Donald Trump Jr. went behind closed doors with members of the House Intelligence Committee. Narrative one, pushed by the Democrats, that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia during the presidential campaign, and that President Trump tried to obstruct justice when he fired former FBI Director James Comey. Narrative two, pushed by the Republicans, that anti-Trump government officials conspired to smear President Trump during the campaign, working for Hillary Clinton behind the scenes, and that opponents misused their power to spy to try to defeat Trump, even going as far as to push a salacious anti-Trump dossier. Well, FBI Director Christopher Wray stepped into the Russia fray at a House Judiciary Committee hearing. Republican Chairman Bob Goodlatte launched allegations of political bias in his opening statement.
Investigations must not be tainted by individuals imposing their own personal political opinions. We do not know the magnitude of this insider bias on Mr. Mueller's team, nor do we have a clear understanding of the full magnitude of bias reflected in the Russia investigation and prior Clinton email investigation. One thing is clear, though. It is absolutely unacceptable for FBI employees to permit their own political predilections to contaminate any investigation.
Ranking Democrat Jerry Nadler said Republicans are trying to create a distraction from what really happened in 2016. Take a listen.
In attempting to shift the conversation away from questions they have largely ignored, like obstruction of justice, election security, and the rise in hate crimes. Indeed, I predict that these attacks on the FBI will grow louder and more brazen as the special counsel does his work and the walls close in around the president and evidence of his obstruction and other misdeeds becomes more apparent.
Some of the more explosive allegations centered around Peter Strzok, an FBI agent who was kicked off Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team over anti-Trump text messages. Republican Congressman Jim Jordan took it a step further, suggesting Strzok was in cahoots with Democrats on the anti-Trump dossier all the way to the uber-secretive FISA court.
If you had the FBI working with a campaign, the Democrats' campaign, taking opposition research, dressing it all up and turning it into an intelligence document and taking it to the FISA court so they could spy on the other campaign, if that happened, that is as wrong as it gets. And you know what? Maybe I'm wrong. You could clear it all up. You could clear it all up for all of us here, all the Congress who wants to know, and frankly, all of America who wants to know. You could clear it all up by release. We sent you a letter 2 days ago. Just release the application. Tell us what was in it. Tell us if I'm wrong. But I don't think I am. I think that's exactly what happened. And if it did, it is as wrong as it can be. And people who did that need to be held accountable.
Congressman, we will not hesitate to hold people accountable after there has been an appropriate investigation, independent and objective, by the Inspector General into the handling of the prior matter. And based on that, I will look at all available remedies, depending on what the facts are when they are found. As to the access to the dossier, that's something that is a subject of ongoing discussion between my staff and the various intelligence committees.
Ray also said the FBI is having extensive interaction with both intelligence committees on interaction with the FISA court. Democrats, including Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, focus on President Trump's attacks on the FBI, specifically that the agency's reputation is in tatters. Ray said his experience has been that the FBI's reputation has been quite good. Jackson Lee also circled back to the Russia probe and alleged misdeeds by the president.
Do you believe, yes or no, can a sitting president commit obstruction of justice?
Congresswoman, legal questions, especially legal questions regarding impeachment, are not something that I'm equipped to answer in this setting as an FBI director.
This is separate and apart from impeachment. Do you believe that a sitting president can commit an obstruction of justice?
That also is a legal question, and I would defer to the lawyers on that one. I'm a now reformed lawyer as an FBI director.
I understand. Is it your opinion that if a sitting president commits a crime, then it becomes a non-crime?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
If a sitting president commits a crime, does it become a non-crime?
Same answer.
Also this week, Donald Trump Jr. declined to tell lawmakers about conversations he had with his father regarding a June 2016 meeting with a Russian lawyer after emails detailing the meeting were made public. Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, said the president's son cited attorney-client privilege, even though neither the president nor Donald Trump Jr. is a lawyer. Schiff said that Trump Jr. bases his claim on the fact that a lawyer was in the room when the conversation happened. Trump Jr. met for more than 10 hours Wednesday with the committee and left without speaking to reporters about what was discussed. By the end of the day Friday, the Russia probe was still clear as mud as both sides stick to their own versions of what happened during 2016. The good guys and the bad guys, the winners and losers, with the rest of us left to mull over what's real and what's fake about the Russia probe.
President Trump made good on a campaign pledge that a few of his predecessors also made, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital city and ordering the State Department to begin making plans to relocate the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. After the announcement, Jessica Rosenthal and Lisa Brady spoke with two people who have been involved with the Mideast peace process. Jessica spoke with Israel's former ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, who now serves in Israel's Knesset. Lisa spoke with David Tufar, who was a foreign policy advisor for President Obama.
Why do you think President Trump is taking this kind of stand after years of it being a totally different way? And as far as you're concerned, is this the right stand?
Well, first of all, it's very much the right stand. It's a moment that we in Israel have been waiting for 70 years since the creation of our state. It corrected an aberration, a symmetry, where our principal ally in the world, the United States, did not recognize our capital. We had no problem recognizing Washington, D.C. as the United States capital. And it created tremendous obstacles even on the ground. And over half the Jewish population in Jerusalem lives beyond what is sometimes referred to as the 67 lines. And every time they built a balcony on their houses, they were condemned as illegal settlement builders. And this announcement will, I think, correct that great historical injustice. Why the president did it this moment, he said it was the right thing to do. He said it that decades of not doing it had not advanced the peace process of one inch. This was a decision made by Congress in 1995. So contrary to being a departure from longstanding American policy, it was the waivers that didn't implement the congressional resolution. Those were the departures from U.S. policy. He has made this, he has brought American policy back into line, as Congress determined in 1995.
What will this mean for settlement building? Will settlement building increase because of this?
Well, settlement increase, it won't increase because of this. What the president has done, and I think very prudently, is that he's taken three of the major obstacles to advancing in the peace process and almost removed them. One obstacle was by saying that the outcome of the talks would be a two-state solution. Now, that created a great difficulty, because if you're a leader of a country and you already know in advance the outcome of negotiations, you're going to be very hesitant to go into negotiations and make painful sacrifices, concessions. I know the Palestinian leaders had trouble explaining to their own people, hey, if the Americans are already giving us a state at the end of the process, why am I going into this process? Why are you making those concessions? So the president has removed that. Previous administrations put the settlement issue up front. And we know that there was an Arab-Israeli conflict for 50 years before the first settlement was built. We know that Israel, since the year 2000, has made two offers of Palestinian statehood to the Palestinians, including redividing Jerusalem. The Palestinians turned it down, both cases, not because of settlements. So settlements were not the obstacle. And the third issue really has been Jerusalem. And putting the Jerusalem issue up front, the president has now said it's Israel's capital. We'll negotiate the borders of Jerusalem just like we'll negotiate all the other borders. So what I believe he's done, and I'm saying this as someone who has been in negotiations, is that he has opened the field in a way that it has not been opened now in a generation, to sitting down and putting everything on that table.
I have to ask, is part of you worried? I mean, you work with the Netanyahu administration now, and you have people like the Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas saying this is playing into the hands of extremism, what President Trump has done. You have King Salman in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia saying this is a dangerous step, and it constitutes a flagrant provocation of Muslims all over the world. Others expressing, I guess, alarm, saying this is essentially a move that could cause dangerous reactions and problems, putting the fragile peace process at risk. What do you make of your neighbors saying this?
Well, I don't expect them to be delighted by this decision. And there have been many decisions made by the United States over the years that didn't delight the Arabs. I can remember one decision back in 1973 when during the Yom Kippur War and Israel was hard-pressed, running out of ammunition, the Nixon administration mounted a major airlift. Actually provided us with thousands of tons of ammunition and arms. That didn't delight the Arabs, but it made them respect Henry Kissinger a lot, and he was able to forge the beginning of peace treaties between Israel and Egypt. Later became the basis for the peace treaties between Egypt and Jordan. I think we have to have the longer view of what's happening here. And yes, while this decision may not be to the liking of our neighbors, ultimately I know that they will respect the president more for having made it. And when you're in negotiations, the American credibility is absolutely essential.
But David Tafuri, a former Obama campaign foreign policy advisor, says moving the embassy doesn't help the U.S. or Israel.
It's not going to make it any easier for us to do diplomacy. In fact, arguably, it's going to make it much more difficult because most of the other embassies are in Tel Aviv still, not in Jerusalem. It's going to be harder for us to secure our embassy. It'll be more dangerous to have an embassy in Jerusalem, and it's going to be very costly for us. But with no actual impact in terms of moving forward the peace process.
Tafuri says the president should be focusing on a plan to get the Israelis and the Palestinians back to the bargaining table. And this isn't just political. Jerusalem is home to Jewish, Christian, and Muslim holy sites.
Religion and politics, unfortunately, it shouldn't be, but unfortunately, they are mixed together. And for instance, in the majority Arab Muslim countries, they are going to be opposed to this for both reasons. They find this to be objectionable to them, to their support for their Muslim brothers in Palestine, and they also find it to be objectionable on sort of a human rights and political level in terms of it making it more difficult for us to move toward a situation where Palestinians in the Palestinian territories have the right to self-determination, have the right to have a government, and ultimately have a right to have a separate state. That's the two-state solution that we should all be supporting.
The UN Secretary General says he opposes any unilateral measures that could jeopardize the prospects for peace and that there's no alternative to the two-state solution. Fox's Jessica Rosenthal asked the former Israeli ambassador about that.
Well, let's go back to the UN. To my mind, the UN is one of the great obstacles to peace. The UN, which condemns Israel more frequently than all of the countries in the world combined, that's an obstacle to peace. The two-state solution, here I have a personal view, which is that the two-state solution should be held up as a vision for the future, not as necessarily an operating contract for the present, because the Palestinians are I cannot think of an example in history that would prove that the Palestinians are capable of establishing now a viable, sustainable, peaceful nation state. They're going to have to build it. It took us 60 years to build this country. let's give the Palestinians a chance to build their state from the bottom up and not throw it on top of a foundation that doesn't exist.
So what happens next? Does one side reach out to the other and say, hey, okay, when are we meeting? Or, I mean, I know that hasn't
well,
really
that's been our position
in the past.
That's been our position for the last 8 years. It was eight right. years ago that the Palestinians left the negotiating table, and they haven't come back since. Our position has been that we're willing to have direct negotiations without preconditions anywhere, anytime, including tonight.
That will do it for this edition of the From Washington podcast. Next week, the Republican advantage in the Senate could shrink if Democrat Doug Jones upsets Republican Roy Moore in Alabama's special Senate election, a race that is being run in the middle of a national conversation about sexual harassment and abuse, not to mention political implications for the GOP tax bill. If you enjoy this From Washington podcast, then you will love the Fox News Rundown, our new daily podcast, analysis and insight on the day's biggest stories straight to your phone every morning. You can subscribe to that and all of our Fox News Radio podcast on Apple or wherever you search for new audio content. And as always, stay up to date on the very latest with your Fox News Radio affiliate and our social media landing pages on Twitter and Facebook. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.